Chair Nornes, I have a question.
Judge Breyer, yes.
Thank you. Just from last night and when we finished, I know there is an amendment that was we were not able to pass because we didn't have a quorum when we reconvened after recess, and I just wanted to inquire if we'll be considering that at a later date.
We will be doing that at a later time.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. I call the meeting to order of the Higher Education Committee, and we have two sets of minutes to approve before we proceed with witnesses today. First of all, from February the 22nd. Someone like to make a motion to approve the minutes from the 22nd?
Mr. Chairman, with the minutes.
Representative Christensen moves the minutes. Any comments, corrections, questions? Other than that, all those in favor of the minutes for the 22nd of February, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Those minutes are approved. Then February the 28th, we have another set of fine minutes. Fine program, I think it was, if I remember right.
Chair, I'll move that the minutes of the 28th be approved.
We have a motion to approve the minutes. Any discussion? Questions? Not? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Try it again. All in favor. Say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Anybody opposed? Okay. Minutes have been approved. Well, we have a full day here, or full committee meeting of testimony, all dealing with the University of Minnesota, and we're looking forward to this today. And I'd like to begin by welcoming Dr. Eric Kaler, president of the university. And you've got quite a team following you around today.
We do, Chair Nornes. Thank you very much. We're delighted to be here today and talk about the University of Minnesota, and welcome to the members of the committee. I, for the record, am Eric Kaler. I'm the president of the University of Minnesota, and I'm grateful for this opportunity to detail for you the University of Minnesota's biennial budget request and explain to you how it aligns with the real needs of our students, their families, our faculty, and most importantly, the people of the state of Minnesota. I'm pleased to be joined here today by the newly re-elected regents from the 8th District of Minnesota, Dave McMillan. Our state needs to continue to have a strong top 10 nationally ranked public research university to create new knowledge, cures, and products for the common good. A university that includes the state's best and brightest students who will be thoughtfully prepared for the jobs of the future in the state's increasingly diverse workforce. As it has for more than a century and a half, our state needs a group of well-educated citizens who strive to keep Minnesota among the nation's healthiest, most innovative, and most productive states. We all need affordable excellence from our state's land-grant university, and that's what we do on all five of our campuses, from Crookston to Rochester, from Morris to Duluth, and in the Twin Cities. And that's why we've come before you today with a budget request that is focused on student success and workforce development. It's focused on research that intersects with the urgent needs of the state's businesses and citizens. It's focused on keeping a lid on tuition for Minnesota residents, and it's focused on serving Minnesota citizens in all 87 of our counties. In just the past month or so, you may have read or heard of research breakthroughs generated by the tireless work of our faculty. Research that helps pork producers respond to the changing needs of consumers while operating efficient farms. Research using MRI technology that can predict if some infants will be affected by autism and that will allow interventions earlier to help those students, those children, and their families. Research in one of the nation's most comprehensive academic health centers that developed a drug to treat a certain cancer in dogs, but that also has great potential to treat a similar cancer in humans. Research that allows robotic arms to be controlled by brain signals, with extraordinary implications for people with disabilities, spinal cord injuries, and for amputees. These are outcomes and discoveries that simply would not exist but for the University of Minnesota. And if you add that research part of our mission to our teaching and public outreach, it means graduating 15,000 new members of the workforce every year. It means extension having an impact in all 87 counties. It means preparing agriculture leaders and educators for our schools and civil engineers for our cities and counties. It means, simply put, Minnesota is a stronger state. And that means the University of Minnesota is indispensable. To continue to be indispensable, we need the resources to deliver on our land-grant mission. We must continue to attract and retain world-class faculty who engage in groundbreaking research, even as we compete for them in a global marketplace for scholarship and invention. We need the resources to ensure our students can get the right classes and receive the appropriate advising so they can graduate in 4 years or less and become the employees all of our industries and organizations need, particularly in the STEM fields. We need the resources to sustain the affordable excellence that is our goal. To get there, we want to build on our historic partnership with you to invest in the university, its students, and its faculty. And to get there, we're seeking your approval of our focused budget request. Other presenters, a fair number of them, will describe for you how each of our budget areas was designed to match a key need at the university. Our core request addresses our inflationary costs and the importance of providing day-to-day resources. Our student success piece is designed to help students graduate on time and keep costs low. You'll hear how our MnDrive and NRRI requests address identified state research needs. And you'll hear how the health training component of the request fills the hole the state left for family medicine and the mobile dental clinic, and how the Bell Museum request allows the university to fulfill the state's requirement to manage its natural history museum. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just one more point I want to emphasize before I turn this over to my colleagues. This request is not only designed to address our university's needs. It aims to push the state boldly and thoughtfully into the future. Like few other institutions that come before you, we are in the business of fueling Minnesota's future by preparing the next generation of Minnesota's leaders in just about every field, by discovering the next breakthroughs and cures for Minnesotans, and by always strategically partnering with you, with industries, and with communities to tackle Minnesota's grand challenges. Again, thank you for this opportunity and your attention. And with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn this over to your constituent, Doug Hetch.
Well, thank you, President Kaler. Before that, I know we have some guests here today, and maybe all are from the university or supporting you, I'm not sure, but we want to welcome you anyway, wherever you're from. And please keep your applause down. Now, Doug is a constituent of mine from Perm, and glad to see him here. He's a graduate of the university, and it isn't often I have a constituent that I introduce in front of these folks, so proud to do it. So, Doug, if you'd identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Sure, thank you, Chairman Nornes, and it's not often I get to testify in front of you either, so this is a thrill for me. My name is Doug Hetch. I'm a farmer, business owner, and an Ottawa County Commissioner. Our farm, New Life Farms, produces turkeys and cattle and recently added honeybees. We employ about 40 people on our farm around Perm and 35 people in our retail businesses. Every year, New Life Farms produces about 8 million turkey hatching eggs for Jenny O Turkey Store. I'm also a proud graduate of the University of Minnesota with a degree in applied economics. My two daughters graduated from the U with degrees in finance and biology. My son is a senior with a job, graduated in May with a degree in supply chain management and MIS. But that's only a fraction of what the U means to me and to millions of other Minnesotans, particularly in greater Minnesota. And that's why I'm here today supporting the university's biennial budget request. Because of its role as the state's only comprehensive research institution, and because of the statewide influence of extension, the University of Minnesota is a major reason why I can compete and succeed as a farmer and business owner. Turkey production is very important to the economy of Otter Tail County and Minnesota. Minnesota is ranked number one in the nation for both turkey production and processing. Otter Tail County is the fifth-ranked turkey-producing county in the state. Minnesota produces 46 million turkeys each year, with 90% of them being exported out of the state. Each turkey generates 17.46 cents worth of economic value to the state, and with 450 turkey farmers who operate 600 farms, that's a lot of economic impact. So you might ask, why am I talking turkey at the University of Minnesota budget hearing? It's pretty simple. If it weren't for the University of Minnesota, the turkey industry wouldn't be here. That's just one of the many, from medical devices to our water industry cluster that wouldn't be here. As it pertains to the turkey industry, in the 1950s, University of Minnesota Extension helped people like my grandfather get started. He was a dairy farmer who was looking to diversify. Extension helped hundreds of farmers like my grandfather create this industry. And throughout our family's 55-year-long history of farming, the U has been there every step of the way. The university helped farmers like us on, among other things, building design and engineering, veterinary diagnostics, nutrition, animal husbandry, and science. In 2015, the University of Minnesota kept our farms afloat during the avian influenza epidemic. On April 13, 2015, we had a small increase in mortality in one of our flocks. Within 4 hours, we had samples at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. And by 10 o'clock that evening, the university called and said the flock was positive for high-path avian influenza. Working in conjunction with the university scientists and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, we were able to contain this to one flock and continue production, stopping the spread of flu in its tracks, and saving our industry and the economies of many counties in our state from devastation. The university's impact extends to just about every farmer in our state, in every county, in every corner, driving Minnesota's global economy and the statewide workforce. And it also extends to many workers in greater Minnesota engaged in the food processing business. Also, as an Otter County Commissioner, I learned that the university's role is just as significant in the area of water. Water is what gives Minnesota its competitive advantage. It is a precious resource we must preserve, and the university and its scientists on all of its campuses are knee-deep in research and public outreach on a variety of water issues. Be it preserving our lakes, tackling groundwater contamination, analyzing irrigation, helping on community development in the mining industry, or battling aquatic invasive species to aid our tourism businesses, the U is there and we will be there. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I heard President Kaler use the word indispensable when describing all the university does for the state. In my experience as a farmer, business owner, and local elected official, I can't think of a more appropriate word. The University of Minnesota has been an indispensable factor in my life and my family's, and of course the lives of so many of all of your constituents. I urge you to support the university's biannual request, and I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. It's odd to call you Mr. Hitch instead of just Doug.
Yeah, it's Doug's
but
fine.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hitch, for that testimony. Now, we have a student here. President Kaler, did you have an introduction?
No, sir. I don't. Elizabeth is completely capable of introducing
herself. It appeared as though you were going to say something. That's why
I can't go to an auction unit.
All right. All right. Please identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nornes and members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Hayskamp, and I'm a senior at the University of Minnesota. In May, I will graduate with a double major in political science and global studies and a minor in Asian languages and literature. I'm originally from southern Wisconsin, but I've been happy to call Minnesota my home for the last 4 years. It's actually funny. Yesterday, 4 years ago, I stepped on the University of Minnesota campus for the first time. It was a cold, dreary February day, but I remember it as warm and exciting because I knew I wanted to come to the University of Minnesota right away. I was only touring that day because I had been accepted here after applying on a whim. Looking back, the tour I went on drastically changed the path my life would take. Like many students who are ready to leave home, I applied to a lot of schools across the country, with my first choice being University of Michigan, my parents' alma mater. It was during second semester of my senior year when I was visiting schools, and the U just happened to be one of them. Once I visited, I knew that the University of Minnesota was the right place for me. It offers high-quality academic programs, a vast learning abroad center, and a Big Ten experience without the outrageous costs that come with schools like University of Michigan. First, the high-quality academic programs. Coming from so close to Madison, I was told by my peers that University of Minnesota was a so-called backup school. However, after digging deeper, I realized this was completely inaccurate. We have a wide array of degree programs, professors, and opportunities that are often undervalued, sometimes because of the long, cold Minnesota winters. I've created great relationships with professors that have inspired my interest in a variety of ways and changed some of the choices I ended up making academically. Along with the ability to work with world-class faculty, I can back up my academics with experience. I ran one of the largest student groups at the U, co-chaired the statewide College Republicans organization, and make a difference through our student government on campus. These organizations have set me up with a network across the country and confidence in my abilities. I was only able to do this because of the 900-plus student groups offered at the U in a variety of interest areas, and I'm so thankful for it. Second, there's the vast Learning Abroad Center. I was afforded the opportunity to study abroad twice, to China and Austria. This was for many reasons, such as the U's connections to global institutions and scholarships. This past August, I got back from a year in Austria that was just as affordable as going to school and living in Minnesota because of the decades-long relationship the U has with Karl Franzens Universität in Graz. This, to me, was unheard of. This focus on letting students experience the world has given me and my peers the opportunity to learn from those raised in different situations and live and work within new cultures. In the global society that's been developed through the internet, I now have an advantage because I've worked and connected with people worldwide. And third is the cost. One of the only reasons I decided to look at the University of Minnesota was due to the affordable price. As a student from Wisconsin, the tuition is comparable to that of University of Wisconsin due to reciprocity. However, in a choice between the two, who wouldn't choose the U? However, as someone who originally thought that they would go to University of Minnesota, or University of Michigan, I'm thankful I toured the U. When I started in 2013, tuition for out-of-state students at the University of Minnesota, Michigan, was $55,000 a year. That was a huge deterrent for me, and I can't afford that. Still can't. I think that Michigan is losing a lot of their diversity in out-of-state students due to the high cost of tuition. I don't want our university to move in the direction of Michigan when it comes to cost, because it will hurt the university and hurt the state of Minnesota. One of the strengths of our university is the accessibility, which brings in talented students from across the country. Once they graduate, they start work at companies like General Mills and Target. These students are invaluable to our state. As I reflect on my 4 years at the University of Minnesota, I feel as though I have an advantage stepping into the real world this coming May because of the opportunities afforded to me here. I can now enter the workforce knowing that I have an extensive academic degree, manageable student debt, and a robust and supportive university behind me. I will be forever thankful for the University of Minnesota and the legislature for investing in me. Therefore, on behalf of students, I believe that the legislature should support the budget request. Funding the University of Minnesota shows that you believe in helping keep tuition affordable, ensuring that students have the tools necessary to enter the workforce prepared, and that a strong university leads to a strong Minnesota. I urge you to fund the university for students now and in the future. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Just a quick question, Elizabeth.
Yeah?
Since you've moved to Minnesota, were you paying then the in-state tuition?
Or
did
no.
You have to pay out-of-state tuition?
I'm reciprocity receiving because my permanent address is still in Wisconsin.
Okay.
But I am happy to announce that I was offered a job in Minnesota today and accepted. So.
If you need any references, we got a bunch of them right now.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, we'll now switch presenters and bring a focus on our core budget requests with Vice Presidents Burnett, Provost Hanson, and one of our students, Harrison Quinn.
All right, we want to begin. Tell us your name first and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Brian Burnett. I'm the Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations for the University of Minnesota. And as President Kaler expressed, we work every day to maintain and strengthen the activities that make the university an educational and economic engine of the state of Minnesota. We ask ourselves, what does it take to maintain this excellence? What cost increases will we face, and what investments will need to be made? What do we really need? And this leads to our highest priority request to you for the next biennium, support of our core mission. We are asking for an appropriation increase of $22.6 million in FY18 and an additional $23 million in FY19. At this time, we are projecting cost increases that equate to roughly 3.5% of our O&M appropriation and tuition base. These are costs associated with, broadly, in compensation. We feel it is essential to fairly compensate our talented workforce through competitive salaries and benefits. And since this single item represents over 60% of our annual budget, it's an extremely important element in our success. Facility costs related to utilities, new building operations, and repairs and renovations are also part of the budget plan. Particularly when we haven't had a recent HEPA appropriation, these are now falling on our operating budgets to maintain these buildings on our campuses. We have technology challenges for our classrooms and our research infrastructure around licensing, maintenance, and security of our IT systems, and a wide variety of specific needs that vary from year to year but fall into categories such as faculty hires, compliance, student services, library collections, and health and safety challenges. We are asking the state to partner with us in covering these needs. The core mission request would address roughly half of the projected general cost increases. The university will address the other half. We have said we will minimize tuition increases on our resident students at all levels, and we will continue to look at modestly increasing our non-resident tuition rates, but we will definitely be reallocating internal resources to help address these needs. Existing resources will be used to reduce or eliminate current expenditures to put towards these needs. By retaining our talented faculty and staff and supporting our excellent student academic program, this all can take place in our environments that are safe, attractive, and energizing to attract the students of today and the students of tomorrow and the workforce for the state of Minnesota. With that, I'd like to turn this over to Provost Hansen to talk about the next specific piece of our budget request with respect to investing in student success.
Welcome, and if you could also state your name for the record, and then go ahead.
I'm Karen Hansen. I'm the Executive Vice President and Provost of the University of Minnesota. So good afternoon, Chair Nornes and members of the committee, and thank you for this opportunity to continue the conversation that we began last month. When legislators raise thoughtful questions about student experiences and success and about what's needed to support students' timely graduation. The University of Minnesota has made great strides in improving graduation rates over the past decade, in large part because of a purposeful investment in student success initiatives. These initiatives will require additional investments to ensure the success of all students, especially those most at risk of not completing a degree. The institution has invested in a number of things, scheduling improvements, credit hour requirement review, course pathways. We need to do more at this point to bring some of these institutional changes to the individual needs of our students. I'll describe how a new investment by the state would support the system-wide student success initiative, which is designed to improve retention and graduation rates, reduce student debt, and enhance students' successful entry into productive participation in our workforce. I'd like to underscore as well the connection between graduation rates and improved financial outcomes for students. Students who graduate in 6 years borrow, on average, $8,067 more than those who graduate in four. And, of course, they also forego salary earnings over those 2 years, a loss that will never be recovered. A cornerstone of our proposed initiative is the Student Success Center, which would support students most in need, including under-resourced students, undecided students trying to negotiate the many majors at the University of Minnesota, and the nearly 4,300 students who transfer to our U of M campuses each year. As I'm sure you know, choosing a major is one of the most important and fraught decisions students make during their college years. Nearly 77% of freshmen and 47% of transfer students are at the undecided stage with respect to their major choice, which is typical for a large flagship university anywhere in this nation. It's to be expected, but exploring and even changing majors can be a natural part of the educational process as students develop their emerging interests and learn more about their skills. They find out what they love and where they can excel. But exploration of majors must be purposeful and well executed, or it can lead to educational delays. For first-generation or low-income students, navigating college and making these academic decisions and seeing their career implications can be particularly challenging. These students particularly, but all students generally, benefit from focused and intensive support early in their college career. Such support helps ensure that students choose a major that fits their talents and goals and helps ensure that they graduate with a college degree that allows them to lead meaningful, productive lives contributing to society. We've seen great success with our Twin Cities-based Center for Academic Planning and Exploration, which we refer to as CAPE, which serves as a pilot for the proposed Student Success Center. CAPE's intensive student support model is an innovative and high-demand resource that directly contributes to increased retention and student success, especially for traditionally under-resourced students. The legislative request seeks to expand these services to meet the needs of more students. This includes transfer students. Nearly 34% of the Twin Cities entering class, that's about 2,800 to 3,000 students each year, is comprised of transfer students, a much higher percentage than nearly all of our peers. This benefits the state by providing an additional U of M path of access to our flagship campus, but it's a model of operation that will work optimally when there is considerable transition support focused on transfer students. We would like to support our many transfer students as we do our freshmen, who have access to an array of carefully designed first-year experiences. With additional investments, we'll be able to expand academic advising support to reach transfer students prior to arrival. This will help them find the best major, align their coursework to ensure timely graduation, and help them discover and participate in crucial co-curricular experiences, such as research opportunities and supervised community engagement and service. With over 40% of our transfer students coming from Minnesota State University schools, investing in the success of transfer students is investing in students and families throughout all of Minnesota. The state's investment would also expand our capacity for highly sought-after STEM majors. The increased demand for STEM education from students and from business and industry is felt on all campuses, and we need to make a significant investment in additional faculty in order to expand these programs. The university is committed to the success of all our students, but the paths to success are individual, varied, and local. As we develop programs and services that support progress toward earning a degree, we must attend to the different needs of all our campuses and to our varied student populations. I want to mention particularly the importance of institutional support for low-income and first-generation students and for students of color. The Student Success Initiative outlined in the university's legislative request provides a roadmap for continuing to improve the retention and graduation rates for all students on all campuses. And now, I'm delighted to introduce to you Harrison Nguyen, a senior who is graduating in 4 years with a double major in psychology and communication studies. Harrison is a first-generation student who, as a former CAPE student and a President's Emergent Scholar, has received the kind of support I've been describing to you today.
Harrison, welcome. You get the low chair. I don't know that I was in two other committees in the same room, and that chair just seems to show up all the time. Now we can see better. Do you want to introduce yourself for the tape, and then go ahead and proceed?
Yep. My name is Harrison Nguyen. I am a fourth year at the University of Minnesota. I would like to say good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee, and thank you for having me. I want to talk a little bit about my experience with the U and how it has affected me to this point. And for context, I grew up in a household where my mom played the role of both a mother and a father. She never finished high school, but what she missed in school, she made up for in love. But no matter how much she loved me, she could not help me nor give me advice about what to expect when I was nearing the end of my high school experience. I ventured on my own into the intimidating process of applying to college, equipped with nothing but an open mind and a handful of hope. I cannot express the joy I felt when I was accepted into the University of Minnesota because I knew I could start working towards finding a career to provide for my mother, as well as to thank her for everything she has done for me. But two questions taunted me the moment I set foot on campus for the first time. What will I major in, and who am I going to become? I did a lot of exploring on my own, but eventually I found my way at the doorstep of Kate. My CAPE coach welcomed me in and helped me figure out my interests and strengths. He never once told me what to do. Instead, he helps direct my thought process towards research and self-reflection. After a series of sessions and nights contemplating on the person I wanted to be, I was finally able to realize my calling of psychology and communication studies. What I learned from programs like CAPE is that despite having to face different adversities and struggles, I never have to do anything alone. As I'm preparing to graduate this May, I am now one step closer to grasping my dream of being able to thank my mother. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And you are applying for some jobs too, like the other student.
Yep.
Again, the offer, we'll give you references if you need. Sounds like you've got a good future.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. President Kaler.
Thank you, Chair Nornes. And again, with your permission, we will shift our focus to medical research in the medical school, and I'll ask our medical school colleagues led by Dean Brooks Jackson to come to the table.
Dr. Jackson, welcome.
Yes, Chair Nornes, members of the committee, I'm Brooks Jackson, Dean of the Medical School and Vice President for Health Sciences at the University of Minnesota. Our MinDrive program, which is a partnership between the university and you, represents a unique collaborative research model involving interdisciplinary research projects across the university and partnerships with industry, which is a key component. MinDrive began in 2013 with the initial investment of $18 million annually in four research areas: robotics, global food, environment, and brain conditions. This year we are asking you to partner with us again to expand MinDrive to four new areas: strengthening communities, clean and abundant water, harnessing big data to drive our economy, and expanding access to clinical trials for cancer care with a request of $32 million for the biennium. The existing MinDrive, which you've funded, has been an unqualified success. A few examples. MinDrive supported researchers at the university submitted 184 disclosures for inventions and intellectual property from this effort, helped launch 13 startup companies, funded 17 graduate fellowships to provide leadership in transdisciplinary collaborative projects, leveraged $167 million in state, federal, and private funding, including major companies such as Boston Scientific and Cargill, and the National Science Foundation and National Institutes of Health. Fostered 325 new partnerships with Minnesota businesses and organizations, including 3M, Medtronic, Cargill, and Tonka Waters. We are looking to build on that success and continue to address areas of serious need for Minnesota with our request for the next phase of MinDrive. We once again focus on our strengths, expertise, and resources at the University of Minnesota, while further addressing the needs of the state, its residents, and industries. And I'll talk about one of these areas in particular, and that's on expanding clinical trials for cancer care for Minnesotans. Nearly half of Minnesotans will be diagnosed with a potentially life-threatening cancer in their lifetime. One out of four Minnesotans will die of cancer. It is the leading cause of death in our state, and I would bet that nearly everyone has been affected by this frightening disease in one way or another. To improve outcomes, local healthcare providers around the state need access to new knowledge about cancer research breakthroughs, as well as access to the full menu of new options for patient care that are not available locally. In the last 5 years, there has been tremendous breakthroughs in new cancer drugs. I think one of the is best demonstrated, I think people know about President Jimmy Carter and the cancer drug he received for his brain cancer, which cured him. You know, these drugs are extremely promising, but the majority of these are still not available because they're not been licensed and thoroughly tested through clinical trials to be approved by the FDA. So access to these drugs can be extremely important and in many cases life-saving, as in President Carter's case. So improving access to cancer clinical trials is one way to advance in this area and provide access to potentially life-saving therapies. However, clinical trials are currently concentrated in this state, in the metro area, in Rochester, and distance from a clinical trial site is a limiting factor for care for many Minnesotans. In fact, 56% of Minnesotans live more than 30 miles away from a cancer clinical trial site. Some parts of the state have the highest rates of cancer, have the least access to new treatments and discoveries. And you can imagine, you know, if you're a patient with cancer, this is obviously a frightening disease. It's very serious. It can be painful. So to have to travel a long distance to potentially get access to a life-saving, potentially life-saving therapy is a real ordeal. And not just for the patient, but for their family members as well, having many of them who work, and it's difficult to get time off to maybe travel 100 miles to come down to the university to get access to this these new treatments. So what we're proposing is to expand these clinical cancer trials throughout Minnesota. In local areas, many of these would be in your districts, to partner with local physicians and providers that will provide more choice and access to the latest treatments and more hope for these families. In addition to expanding our ability to run more clinical trials, this will speed up research and we will get answers faster and drugs and devices will be licensed more quickly. And it will advance the time in which they will be available to the general public. So I think this is extremely important for the majority of Minnesotans, in which this is difficult if the current licensed therapies are less than effective. Sometimes there is no other choice except these new drugs. So I think this really will be extremely important to many of Minnesotans in this state. So now I'd like to turn the presentation over to Dr. Vitek, sitting next to me, who is the chair of neurology at the medical school at the University of Minnesota. He's been involved in the brain science part of MnDrive and has advanced the work in this area considerably at the national level, and I'd like to have him tell you about the success of the MnDrive, this MnDrive project in particular that you have funded.
Before it begins, I just wanted to add that I'm very happy to hear what you're talking about with the clinicals for cancer treatment. Just lost a neighbor yesterday to cancer. We also have a cancer treatment and research center right in my community, which is unusual for a town of about 13,000 people. So I'm sure they'll be very happy to partner with you in any way to advance. And I think even the federal government is sending signals that they're going to try to speed up some of these drugs and the treatments, because it's very important. So now, sorry to delay your, but we just need just a little interlude there. Now we're ready for Dr. Vitek, is it?
Yeah, Vitek.
Vitek.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Vitek. I'm the chair of the Department of Neurology at the University of Minnesota. A little bit of background for me is I grew up in a small town in northern Minnesota, Meadowlands, between Hibbing and Duluth. Coming back to Minnesota has been a real plus for me because people actually know about Meadowlands every now and then. It was a small school. 23 kids in my class. Frankly, we had played hitman football. My dad had an eighth grade education. Mom worked for $1.25 an hour. Couldn't always pay the grocery bill. But education was pretty important in the family. And I think my family, even though they didn't have a lot of it, felt that it was important that we go on. I had the opportunity to go to UMD for undergrad. My MD and my PhD were both done here. I went off then to other places and did some work at Johns Hopkins, went to Emory University, went to Cleveland Clinic, and came back 7 years ago to chair the department. And there's three reasons I came back. The first one was my wife wanted to come back. That was important. The second one was that we wanted to live on a lake. I'm a true Minnesotan. I needed access to lakes. I hadn't had it for 26 years. But the most important reason, all seriousness, was the science at this institution is tremendous, absolutely tremendous. It is the reason that I really came back. It made my wife very happy, so that was a bonus. My area of interest is actually neuromodulation. This is a scenario, I do mainly deep brain stimulation. That's where we implant an electrode that's a small device, about 1.3 millimeters in diameter. We put it in different structures in the brain, And we can actually improve signs and symptoms of things like Parkinson's disease, tremor, dystonia. We're working on things in psychiatric areas now. There's a trial for Alzheimer's disease. We're looking at addiction. There have been studies for depression. So it's a very important area. And frankly, MnDrive was developed when I got here, and we've been able to use the MnDrive resources to make us, I believe, the number one program, not just in this country. I would argue, and I think many people would agree in the field, that we're the best program in the world. We have used the resource to recruit world-class faculty. We've got infrastructure. And we're training, most importantly, we're training the next generation of physician scientists to come through to keep advancing this field. I can't say enough about the benefit we've received from the MnDrive resources.
Doctor, I just wanted to interrupt for a second, but I saw a demonstration of that up at UMD a few years ago.
I remember we talked up there.
That was unbelievable.
I mean, it's been fantastic. And I can say I've done probably since we started doing this back in the 90s when I was at Emory and then continued off to Cleveland and here. Parkinson's patients who are disabled can now walk, go back to work. Tremor patients, tremor can go away. Kids with dystonia that are wheelchair-bound for years are now running and walking. And if you think about the fear pressure with a kid who's maybe 12 years old with horrible dystonia, which is basically the involuntary muscle contraction set, and now stand up straight and participate even in sporting events. I've got a guy that's skiing, water skiing, snow skiing.
A neighbor that was diagnosed with Parkinson's early had already committed to having that done at some point. You have to determine when that is, but
yeah.
She is so convinced that that is the answer to her as she develops more symptoms.
Well, it's been a huge plus, I think, particularly for the state of Minnesota, because I think with our program, we are very good at doing this. I'm not going to be a true Minnesotan and not brag about the program. I think it really is a strong program, and largely because of the resources we've received through this MnDrive program. So we've been advancing the care, not only in the state of Minnesota, but actually across the country, and I believe some of the things we're coming up with are advancing in the world. But important to my heart is also growing up in that small town. I got my health care in Floodwood, but I could go only one day a week because that's when the doc was there. He was there one day a week. And what we really want to do with this program is to be able to advance the things we're learning at the university across the whole state of Minnesota. We should be able to make this more available, and that's happening. The second thing that's happening besides advancing the care is I'm interacting with industry. We have three major device companies in town, Medtronic, Boston Scientific, and Abbott, which was St. Jude that Abbott bought them. We've been working directly with them now for a number of years. It's been a very collegial and collaborative interaction that's good both ways, not only for them coming to us, but us going to them with things. We train their people. They've helped train some of ours. And the last thing is the grant money. So NIH grant money is critical for us as an institution. We've been able to obtain a very competitive UDOL grant, which is a P50 grant. It's a $9 million grant. There's only 9 awarded in the country. In order to get one, you have to beat somebody out. The only time you can get it is if you're competing with somebody else. And because of the fact that we have a very multidisciplinary program through MnDrive, which includes neurosurgery, neurology, psychiatry, physical medicine, neuroscience, biomedical engineering, and the Cinderella program at the university, which is the imaging program, the Center for Magnetic Resonance Research, has been kind of the key reason that we've been able to do this. Not only the UDOL grant, but many, many other R01 grants, and so we've been very successful on that front. Right now, I would say that people and corporations are calling us. We get calls all the time for faculty who want to come work with us. It's a matter of being, can we afford to bring them on or not? MnDrive program helps us to support that. We get calls from corporations, all of them, and even new younger ones and startup companies. They want to test out a new device. How can they do that? Well, we've got a major research program which allows them to do that. So I would end by just saying, you know, I've worked at some very good places. Johns Hopkins, Emory, and the Cleveland Clinic are very strong programs. I think we're better than they are. I really think we are better than they are. And I want to keep us better than they are, and I want to keep moving us forward in the field. And really, MnDrive allowed us to do that. With your help, we hope to continue doing that. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for your time.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you highlight the total amount of grant funding that comes in for your program, and maybe the Vice President can also chime in about the total amount of grant funding that comes into your unit?
I think we talked to Duluth, didn't we, as I recall? Didn't you in Duluth?
Probably.
A couple years ago? Yeah. Yeah, because I remember asking that number, and I think, yeah, yeah. So the UDOL grant we didn't have at that time, that's $9 million. We probably have about 7, 8 R01s that are based off of this. Each R01's between probably $2 to $3 million on top of that. And I we'd have to look downstream with the other folks that are getting grants through foundation, et cetera. So we can pull that data together for you. I don't have it offhand. We can pull it together. It's sizable.
All right. Right, Doctor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We will switch gears for the final time and talk to you about the portion of our budget that we consider unfinished business. It's support of our Department of Family Medicine and its clinics, including the dental clinic, support of the Natural Resource Research Institute in Duluth and Coeur d'Alene, and support of the Bell Museum. And again, Vice President Jackson can lead off.
Thank you very much, Chair Norris, members of the committee. For the record, again, I'm Brooks Jackson, Dean of the Medical School and Vice President for Health Sciences. It is my pleasure to tell you about our impact on healthcare access in Minnesota. Our medical school this year was announced as the national leader, number one in providing family medicine physicians in this country. Our department, led by Dr. Mac Baird, who is here, is ranked third nationally in NIH funding and is strongly supported by the state's family physicians, our residents, our faculty, and our students, as you can see by their presence here today. So not only do we train the most number of family medicine physicians, but we are also leading in research in this area as well. Training primary care providers and serving as primary care physicians is a challenging endeavor. It requires partnership. For many years, UCARE has been an important partner to the Department of Family Medicine, allowing us to train the number of residents we do and to continue to serve the underserved at our family medicine clinics, and that's many throughout the state. Their contribution to our mission has varied over the years, but has reached as high as $10 million in some years. As you are aware, UCARE lost its state contract in 2015, which was 70% of its business and was therefore no longer able to support the medical school's primary care clinics to provide training to residents and care to the underserved. UCARE was also an important partner for our dental school. Their partnership allowed us to operate the mobile dental clinic, and many of you have probably seen that bus that goes around the state. It serves communities where preventative primary dental care is difficult to access. In 1 year, this mobile dental clinic was able to perform over 5,400 dental procedures for over 1,200 patients, mostly in greater Minnesota. And while the dental school did receive some funding from the Richard Schultz Foundation and $160,000 from the state last year, that was enough to continue in the interim this year, but not enough to save the program long term. And the dental needs in this state are really quite great. We are here today to ask the state to be our partner so that we can continue to train a record number of family medicine physicians, continue to be a national leader, and continue to provide access to high-quality medical and dental care for Minnesotans. This request is truly a need because without it, we simply cannot continue to do what we do. The Department of Family Medicine estimates that it could mean the loss of up to 40% of family medicine residents that go into practice in Minnesota each year. And it is estimated that Minnesota needs 1,100 new primary care physicians by 2030 due to the aging population and the growing population. That's a 28% increase on top of what we have today. So if we close these residency programs and clinics, we will not have sufficient faculty to teach medical students, partly, which are in the first 4 years, but at the same time, really train the family medicine physicians we need to go out in the communities in Minnesota to provide care. And this is at a time we're also trying to increase our class size in the medical school to serve Minnesota's workforce needs. Each of our programs serves 6,000 to 8,000 patients in underserved populations. This will dramatically impact our ability to provide this care, as well as our national rankings for family medicine and primary care. Again, our dental mobile clinic simply cannot operate without partnership funds. Dental school is facing serious budget deficits, in some part to reimbursement issues. We have some of the lowest dental reimbursement rates in the country and does not have the resources to continue this on our own. But we are proud of our training and service programs, and we know they provide great impact for Minnesotans around the state, and I hope you will support this request. I'd like to now turn this over to one of our family medicine residents, Dr. Lauren Williams. And we can take questions, and Dr. Baer can as well after this.
Welcome to the committee.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Chair Nornes and committee members. Thanks so much for having me today. My name is Dr. Lauren Williams, and I am a family medicine resident from the University of Minnesota North Memorial Program, one of eight family medicine programs in the university's Department of Family Medicine. I'm proud today to represent my fellow residents in speaking with you, and I'm also the current Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians resident director, so I speak on behalf of the 3,100 family medicine physicians that we represent. My goal today is to impress upon you the importance of providing funding support for this department. I wish that in doing so, I could introduce you individually to every single one of my fellow family medicine residents. They are some of the most intelligent, caring, dedicated, and inspirational people that I have ever met. We're a diverse group. We come from all over. We have roots in Marshall, Minnesota, and St. Paul, Nome, Alaska, and the Bronx, and rural China, and Bodega, Colombia. Prior to becoming doctors, we worked as high school teachers, researchers, and even a Guthrie actor. Some of us are single, some have families, but we all chose to train at the University of Minnesota North Memorial Program because of our shared desire to learn how to deliver excellent, comprehensive medical care for patients and to foster wellness in our communities. When we graduate, we take that same passion with us. Following in the footsteps of our predecessors, 90% of whom are still practicing in Minnesota, a third of these in rural areas that already have a great need for increased access to primary care. Because of the university's top-ranked family medicine training, family medicine doctors are coming to Minnesota from throughout the country and then staying to serve our state's population. I myself am originally from Michigan, and I had never set foot in the state of Minnesota before I came to interview with the program. And I'm proud to say that I've already accepted a job offer to stay and work as a family physician in Minnesota after I graduate. So I won't be needing a lot of recommendations.
Good to hear that.
This coming year, however, due to budget limitations, the North Memorial Program will have to accept two fewer residents into our incoming class, a 20% cut. Without the state's funding support, these cuts will continue to occur in our program and the other family medicine programs within the department. This will lead to fewer family medicine physicians trained to care for Minnesota's growing population. In asking for the House to support the proposed funding for the University of Minnesota Department of Family Medicine, we are asking you to make an investment in the family medicine physicians who will steward the health of our state for generations to come. Thank you for your time and your consideration, and I appreciate, and if you have any other questions, please.
Thank you for being here, and good luck.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if we could reserve questions to the end of the presentation, I would appreciate it.
We're
not going anywhere. Very good.
That'll work best.
Thank you, Mr.
Who's
Chair.
Who's the next?
We have two final presenters, and then I'll have a few words to conclude.
Good afternoon, Chairman, committee members. My name is Rolf Lieberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Natural Resources Research Institute at the University of Minnesota. It's a real pleasure to be here as part of the UMN team talking about another topic, which is our natural resources and the industries associated with them. I'm a relatively new addition to the team. I'm a UMD alum from 82, and I left the state after that. Returned about 3 years ago after a 2.5-day retirement from DuPont. I left DuPont as the global technology manager for Building Innovations business, and came here to take over the Natural Resources Research Institute. The Natural Resources Research Institute is largely unknown in our state. It's nationally unique you're not going to find another institute anywhere in the country that has the breadth of capability and comprehensive treatment of our natural resources and how to use them and how to take care of them. It's an applied research arm of the University of Minnesota, which means we focus on the research. We are not part of an academic effort. We interact very strongly with it, however. Minnesota is very, very rich in natural resources. Our mineral wealth, our forests, our water, and our air are envied by states around the country. There are a lot of decisions we need to be making as stewards of this state, and that's where NRI comes in. 1983, NRI was created by the legislature with a lot of prescient thought that went into the charter. The charter is to foster the development of Minnesota's natural resources in an environmentally sound manner to create jobs. Fundamentally, it's a job creator. NRI is a job creator for long-term, well-thought-out economic development. A lot of us like to talk about rocks, water, and wood, but it really does boil down to how do we use those. In 1983, in the mid-80s, NRI is granted a $2.4 million annual base funding level. It has not changed since then. In today's numbers, that's $900,000. Just adjusting that for inflation brings it to $6.2 million. We need $8 million in order to be very efficient and continue the high quality of delivery we celebrate today. Today, we're asking as part of the university budget for an additional $1 million in 2018, and then an additional $2 million to bring us to $5.4 million as a first step to that financial health. To support this request, over the last 2 years, we've taken a bit of a voyage since I showed up. We did an inventory. What do we do well? What do we not do so well? And what are the zombies we have to kill and focus on what we're successful at? We've reorganized, we've focused on return on investment, and now we're engaging today with our new mission and engaging you. Our new mission is to deliver. I like that word. Deliver research solutions. Solutions are much more comprehensive than an answer. Solutions balancing our economy and our environment so we can have resilient communities. And that's really what we need to focus on around here. People need jobs all year round, every year. Our approach is threefold, but really focused on reducing risk to investment, risk to our environment, to develop good long-term opportunities. The first point, reduce waste, which is just reducing costs. Waste is bad business. We're working with a number of companies across the state right now, introducing jobs that give us secondary uses for some of our mining waste that find their way into road patches. Remember those things called potholes? We just licensed them to technology for a company to take that on with a solution we feel is going to come around the state. Second point, broaden our offering and go to higher value. We've got to quit playing at the bottom of the heap. We got to have a broadened offering so we have more resilience in our economy from our natural resource products. And we also have to go for the higher value. Right now we ship out of our state up to 60% of the value of our natural resources and let somebody else make the money. I think we need to keep that here in this state and reinvest it in our own state. It's a great opportunity for us. And finally, the third point is embracing stewardship. It's not a dirty word. It's a competitive advantage. We celebrate it today with our renewable timber, our sustainably harvested timber. It's a competitive advantage in the real world, out in the world that I came from, where you have your designers and builders across the world. We're an applied research organization. Our job is to take any good idea and scale it up. We move from the basic research, of which the University of Minnesota is a deep, deep well, and we work with colleagues at the University of Minnesota and other academic institutions, our industry ties, we have very deep industry engagements, our agencies and our NGOs, to drive good ideas and translate to demonstration and commercialization, again, driving jobs. Collaboration is key to all of that. So the next question, what did you do for me lately? And we like to talk about that word impact. We bring impact to every last county in the state. We have at least 1 to 2 programs in every county. We do this by working together through 6 integrated research initiatives. We narrowed it down to the 6 things we're really good at. Minerals, metallurgy, and mining. At our Coleraine site, we have one of the country's top mineral processing laboratories. We can process anywhere from several grams to several tons. that's relevant to the industry. We have some of the top water scientists that collaborate across the university system, understanding lakes, rivers, and streams in our state. We have a forest and wildlife team that really understands how do you manage our forests and what impact does that have on the wildlife that we'd like to take advantage of with our recreation. Wood products and bioeconomy. What else can we do with our wood stores? Renewable energy and business and entrepreneurial support, because at the end of the day, if we're not supporting our secondary and tertiary industries, it doesn't matter how good your major industries are if you don't have those secondary economies. So what are we doing? A couple of deliverables. Highway 53, the one that's being moved up in northern Minnesota, wouldn't be happening unless NRI did 24/7 core sampling for 7 months to make sure that we weren't encumbering any iron resources and to make sure those little pillars that hold the bridge up stay where we want them to stay. Big impact for the DOT in Minnesota. Just recently, we found a new way to take advantage of Minnesota's ilmenite resources. How many of you know what ilmenite is? It's a titanium iron oxide. We've known about it for 40 years. Nobody could figure out how to make that into a real product. We just piloted a 20-ton sample with some friends in Canada. As now, we've been successful in a commercially pure titanium dioxide product. It's another part of our mineral portfolio that we can take advantage of here in the state that gives us more choices. Lastly, we are working. Last year, the legislature gave us some large project money called the Mining Innovation Grant. We are right now developing and designing a simulator that should let any of our iron industry come into our laboratory and find out how high up the value chain they can go economically with the iron ore we come out with in the state. ArcelorMittal, U.S. Steel, Nucor are all engaged in that work. And finally, we are driving, how do we handle our water in the state? We've got sulfate issues all over the state. How do we do that in an economical way? One other thing we're doing with our forestry resources, when we go take a tree to a sawmill, up to 60% of it is waste. A lot of the sawmills sell those white wood chips to paper companies that make paper out of it. How much paper are we using now? Not as much. So now we're landfill. That's a cost. They're now uncompetitive. We've just built a renewable energy laboratory at the Coleraine site where we can process up to 8 tons of that waste a day into something called a biochar, which is used as a fuel and can partially replace coal in a coal-fired power plant, which has been demonstrated. We're also looking at how do we take things like that and further process it into syngas, which is a carbon monoxide hydrogen mix, which under catalysis can be turned into things like liquid fuels and chemicals. Jet fuel is one of those. There's a big demand for that from the Department of Defense or on our federal level. Finally, energy storage. We've got energy storage capabilities here in the state of Minnesota that make us a battery for the Midwest. These are opportunities that would create jobs that we're driving today as part of our last 2 years. The biggest piece of this is the fact that we are able to engage students. We have an order of, between ourselves and the Center for Economic Development, anywhere near 60 to 80 students during the year. That swells to 120 to 140 during the summer when they're all out slogging through the mud, counting fish, and doing the key work that we need to do in the summertime when things aren't frozen. Bottom line, this is all good stories, but investment is needed. It's unsustainable where we are today. We're having increasing demands for our work. The questions are more and more complex. We have more and more people at the same funding rate. Our average hard funding rate for our scientists is about 10 to 15%, as opposed to what we typically do in a university setting. That means if I hired you for $100,000, you'd raise 90 plus your overhead plus your search costs. I am going to have a third of the organization leave over the next 3 years due to retirements. I am not going to be able to attract the best and the brightest that we would expect at the University of Minnesota with that kind of a funding level. We're a key part of the University of Minnesota team. We're a key part of the future of the state. And the time to invest is now. We need your help. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And we have one
Last but not least.
One more special guest.
Well,
identify yourself and then proceed.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chairman Nornes and committee members. My name is Denise Young, and I'm the executive director of the Bell Museum of Natural History and Planetarium. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to have these few moments to share the importance of the Bell Museum's funding request before you. As a child growing up in rural Georgia, it was a visit to a natural history museum that fostered my lifetime curiosity about the natural world and opened my eyes to a career path in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Later, as a science teacher in a large urban area of North Carolina, I was again reminded of the power of science museums in capturing my students' imaginations and motivating them towards success in the classroom. I share this little bit of personal information to underscore the importance of museums to many people and in many aspects of our lives, to inspire and engage, to educate, and to prepare for employment. And I find this to be especially true of the Bell Museum, now that I've gotten my wits about me and moved to Minnesota. But even more so because of the museum's affiliation with the University of Minnesota. As the official Natural History Museum of Minnesota, the Bell Museum collects, preserves, interprets, and displays the state's natural history, the plant and animal life of Minnesota. At its heart, this museum, which was formed by legislative action in 1872, provides a better understanding of our natural world at many levels. The museum has been achieving this improved understanding of Minnesota's natural history for over 140 years, and it's going to take a giant leap in its potential to impact more Minnesotans in new and deeper ways as we move to a new facility on the University of St. Paul campus in 2018. The new Bell Museum will deliver a fundamentally different, expanded, and improved educational experience, including bringing back a public planetarium to the state. Affiliation with the University of Minnesota is an incredible asset that the Bell Museum leverages for the public's benefit. We are the museum in Minnesota most able to facilitate personal interactions with groundbreaking research about the environment and the scientists leading the way in improving our understanding of our world. Such interactions are crucial to introducing students to STEM career opportunities. Likewise, there's incredible public trust in museums as educational entities. This trust, coupled with the fact that Americans spend only about 5% of their lifetimes in formal schooling situations and learn most of their science in places like museums, means that the Bell Museum will remain and grow further into a powerful force in educating Minnesotans about complex issues affecting our state. We heard about many of those earlier today, agricultural issues, environmental stewardship, disease prevention, and more. Whether it's interacting directly with scientists or our collections on the exhibit path, exploring other planets that might support life in our immersive planetarium, or completing a bee lab in our pollinator garden, visitors will get exactly what parents and teachers and the general public say they need and want most: real life experiences that provide an enthusiastic invitation to get involved in STEM. Our request is crucial to fulfilling our mission and maximizing the recent investment in the new museum facility. Even after accounting for additional revenues and fundraising, a need will still exist to meet the annual operating costs for a larger, more complex, and in-demand museum. As a steward of the state's Natural History Museum, the university has provided well over half of the Bell Museum's operating expenses to now. Unfortunately, it is not in a position to maintain that level of support for the museum's operating needs going forward without affecting other mission programming. The costs for additional staff to operate the museum and meet vastly increased educational requests, to maintain technology-rich learning experiences such as the digital planetarium, and to provide timely replacement and repair of an active public building are more than we can bear on our own, and thus we are here turning to you for some help. So I'd again like to thank you for the opportunity to share the status of the Bell Museum of Natural History and Planetarium, and I thank you for your consideration of our request.
Thank you for your testimony, and President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, please allow me to wrap up our presentation, then we will stand for your questions. we are a strong university because of the investments you and your predecessors have made in us over the past century and a half, and we're thankful and grateful for that. But if we want to continue to be a great, strong university, we need the investments we're seeking. We need to invest in our core operations and our employees. They are the people who help our students to graduate, who prepare our students for the jobs of tomorrow, and who conduct the research that creates new knowledge. Our people make our university indispensable. We need to invest in our research, including cancer research, as you heard. Cancer is the leading cause of death in the state, with over 10,000 Minnesotans dying from it every year. We need to invest in healthcare training across the state and the critical research at the NRRI in Duluth, and importantly in the operations of the state's Natural History Museum, the Bell. Most importantly, we need to invest to keep our excellence affordable to our students. If we don't invest, frankly, tuition will go up, quality will go down, and our students and their families will face new challenges. I urge you to approve our request to keep the University of Minnesota great and the state of Minnesota strong. Thank you for your attention, and we'd be delighted to respond to your questions.
Thank you, President Kaler, and we may have a question or two. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, you talked about the investment. What would you say in the budget request? Is do you have a order of priority for these requests when you're looking at it? What would you say is kind of the most important for the university?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Christensen, we must have the core mission and student success initiatives. Those strike directly at the educational program that we deliver. They're most closely tied to our ability to control tuition. If we don't get funding from MnDrive and MRRI, then the university won't be able to continue to advance important research areas, and the state will miss out on the kind of advantages and opportunities that Dr. Vitek talked about in the medical field, and which we could talk about in the areas of food, water, or advanced manufacturing. These are smart investments that drive a future for Minnesota. And importantly, if we don't get funding for the new Bell, the state's only natural history museum, its programming will suffer just as it opens, and that, in my view, is not a smart thing to do. Finally, I think that the need for investment in the Department of Family Medicine and those programs that educate family medicine docs is compelling.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, if the U gets its entire budget request, will there be a tuition increase?
Chair Nornes, Representative Christensen, we will do our very best to minimize any tuition increase. That involves, at this stage of the game, the 1st of March, lack of knowledge about what some of the compensation parameters will need to be. We will do our very best to minimize a tuition increase for Minnesota residents. I think at the most you would see a 1.5% or 2% increase, and we would probably be able to buffer that for families making under $120,000 a year, as we were able to buffer the last tuition increase we gave for Minnesota residents. We are planning a out-of-state non-resident, non-reciprocity tuition increase. Again, these are tuition rates that are set by the Board of Regents. We will recommend to them a 10% increase in our so-called NR rate for new students, and for out-of-state students who are already undergraduates at the University of Minnesota, we will recommend a 5.5% increase. So those will be our administrative recommendations to the Board, barring any unforeseen surprises.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, President Kaler, I really appreciate your strides you're making in making sure tuition is affordable by in-state students by having a competitive non-resident tuition rate, and I really appreciate the progress and strides you're making in that direction, and I appreciate you giving an overview of how the state's investment will affect tuition. So thank you.
Other questions? Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really appreciate your coming today, President Kaler, and thank you so much to those folks that testified today and spoke about the university. People love to love the University of Minnesota. My kids and I have been to basketball games, and I grow a whole pile of Honeycrisp apples every year, and my B Club is constantly communicating with the university on the latest research and the conversations around beekeeping and whatnot, and I could go on and on. I'm going to ask a slightly more controversial question, but I think there's a good answer. And I just would like to, for a second, go to a doorstep, to, so to speak, because that's kind of what we do, of course, during an election cycle. And while there's so many things that we, like I said, love about the University of Minnesota, there are some folks at Doors that feel that on some issues the university has lost some of its moral credibility. And your office, President Kaler, has been incredibly transparent. Anytime I've had questions, you've come, you've talked to me about those things, and that's really been a great relationship for me. But not everybody gets to see that. And I guess maybe if you could just for a moment talk a little bit about some of the things that the university is doing to restore that foundation.
President Kaler.
Chair Nornes, Representative Heinzman. We work hard every day to maintain and to the extent we need to regain trust of the public in our institution. We've had some bumps in the road in the 6 years I've been president. We surely have. We had controversy in our Department of Psychology and the involvement of human subjects in research. I'm not going to blame others. When I arrived, I looked at that situation. I was assured by many people that things were just fine. And it turned out, over a period of time, we were persuaded to take a deep look in the Department of Psychiatry, and things weren't so fine. And we've worked very hard over the past year and a half, now plus 2 months, to restore faith in that. And I think if you have a chance to talk to the new chair of the Department of Psychiatry, and you get a chance to talk to our interim vice president for research, they will tell you we have made great strides in restoring trust in that portion of our research enterprise. We've had some challenges with personnel who behaved inappropriately, and we've removed those institutions from the university, called in external teams to look at our processes and practices, and I think as the quality of the individuals that we've hired as our new athletic director and our new football coach demonstrate, we are committed to high standards of integrity and ethics, and I feel, as I visit some of those same proverbial doorsteps that you describe, a sense of renewed confidence in the university in those two very visible areas where we have had challenges. So I feel good about where we are. I think there's always opportunities to make further progress. I think there's always opportunities to come together with those who believe we should not do things, whether it's a particular kind of research or a particular kind of medical treatment, and work to continue to find the middle ground where we can satisfy the desires of our constituencies and the citizens of the state of Minnesota while still maintaining rigor and truth in our adherence around academic freedom and the ability to do scientific research. But that's a work in progress, and I appreciate you notice that I am open and transparent and willing to discuss and reach a point where hopefully all can agree.
Representative Justin.
Thank you, Chair. President Kaler, I just want to make sure for clarification that we have our numbers correct.
Sure.
If I can, we did have the presentation, which I think all of your team went through, and I'm looking at those numbers relative to the numbers that are on this sheet here. And I believe that the numbers on this sheet here for 2019 may have some errors. And I want to get clarification. If you look at support core missions, when we had the presentation, 22.6 is requested for fiscal year 18, and then for fiscal year 19, it's 23 million, but on this sheet, it's listed as 45.6.
Ah. Representative Jessup, thank you, Chair Nornes, with your permission. That's important, and I'm very glad you raised that. There is a thing called biennial math, which is very confusing. So on the slide that I have up here, it says support core mission, and you see it says the request is incremental over prior year. So in other words, in FY18, we would ask for $22.6 million. In FY19, we would ask for that same $22.6 million plus $23 million more. And so if you add 23.0 and 22.6, I think you get 45.6, and that's the number that is in the middle column of this page. So it's a biennial math, and I actually noticed that when the slide went up and appreciated the chance to clarify that.
All right. Very good. Representative Jessup. Thank you. One other question, different subject. Thank you, Representative Christensen, for asking about the tuition. Right now, as my understanding is, your student makeup is 65% from the state and 35% from out of state. If you increase the out of state tuition by 10%, is the demand from out of state prospective students high enough that you will be able to retain that ratio going forward, or do you anticipate there will be a shift in your student makeup?
Chair Nornes, Representative Jessup, that's an excellent question. Let me, for the sake of the numbers I'm about to quote you, use a number of 70%, which is the system-wide number of Minnesota high school students in our on all five campuses. Our challenge, as Elizabeth alluded to, sorry, that's not actually a challenge. We're delighted to have her here. Is our reciprocity tuition. So about 16% of our students come from reciprocity states, Wisconsin, the Dakotas, and oddly enough, Manitoba, which is not a state but has reciprocity. And so those students pay the reciprocity rate, which is close to the tuition they would pay in their home state. So they do not pay the full out-of-state tuition rate. So that really only leaves 14% of our population, and that's about evenly divided between international students and students from so-called non-resident, non-reciprocity states, NR. And so it's that tuition that we are moving up to get closer to the midpoint of the Big Ten, to reach the midpoint of the Big Ten eventually. And your question is an excellent one, and it worries me to death, because I am not sure what the price elasticity of demand is for that population. You can make an argument because non-resident, non-reciprocity students choose to go to Ohio State and pay that higher out-of-state tuition, and we're better than Ohio State. That's being recorded. So there's an argument that says that. On the other hand, I do worry that you certainly can increase the tuition rate by 10% and reduce the number of students that come by 11% and lose money on the deal. So we're watching this very, very carefully, and that's the reason that we're taking these relatively small 10% jumps, which is about $2,500, rather than a big jump to the middle of the Big Ten, all in all. But we're watching that very carefully, and frankly, we intend to make money on NR students, which is the product of what they pay times how many come. And if we begin to see a softening of our ability to move that price point, we're going to pull back on that throttle a little bit. But it's a economic experiment in progress.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And President Kaler, you speak well of a land-grant institution who has invested mightily in rock, wood, and water. And while that being said, I also want to ask you a question with regard to Adams and with regard to an installation that we have about a quarter mile down a shaft at the Sudan mine. And Mr. Chair, I have a couple follow-ups, but just to start down this trail, I'm just wondering what progress or what is the status of that facility down that shaft?
Chair Nornes, Representative Albright, I first, for the record, will tell you that I have refused to go down that shaft because it frightens me to death to be in that elevator. And so as a consequence, I can't give you an up-to-date and in-depth answer to that as I sit here today, so we will get back to you as soon as possible with an update on where we are. I maybe can phone a friend who knows, however.
Well, got a lot of friends. And Mr. Chair, and while he's making his way down, My interest was piqued by your conversation about the performance metrics, and with regard to the advancement of economies and the diversification of our economy. Obviously, we are a land-grant institution that is preeminent in a number of industries. But I'm just wondering if you've thought about how that, with the atom and with the stars being a natural extension to that, I'm wondering where that takes us in terms of enhancing our ability to do research that literally could not be replicated in any other area of the country.
This is very good. So let me ask Mr. Weber to respond about the mines, please.
Mr. Weber. I've actually been down there three times.
Well, you're a good man.
Sorry. The experiment that was being done at the mine, they got as much information out of that experiment as they could get. And the experiment has terminated, and under agreement between the University of Minnesota and the DNR was that once the experiment was completed, all the equipment would be removed. And that's happening right now. It'll be complete at the end of September. At that point, the cavern that the experiment has been in, the Minas experiment, will be empty, and it will cost the state on the order of $100,000 a year to keep it temperate, keep below 100% humidity and above 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's a cost that they aren't going to consider at this point in time, and there's not another experiment to be in there. We still have the Ash River complex, which is further north in Minnesota, but the experiment that Minos was, you know, the atom, if you will, the neutrino experiment, has shifted to South Dakota because they have a deeper mine there, and they needed to have a deeper mine to continue the experiment. They learned as much as they could from the Sudan mine. However, that cavern is the next likely candidate for a demonstration of compressed air energy storage, so we're looking to try to rehabilitate that. So.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I look forward to taking a tour with the President.
Jared Norris, Representative Albright, I will be heavily sedated, but I will be able to tell you in answer to your second question. We have a range of experimental facilities at the university that are, to use an overused word, unique. We have an MRI facility that enables brain imaging with the highest resolution, at least until recently, currently available in the world. It's a remarkable research tool and enables, in addition to the neuroscience that Dr. Vitek described, the neuroimaging that we're able to do to be unmatched by anybody else in the world. We have in our chemical engineering and material science department a electron microscope that, instead of simply taking pictures of atoms, takes movies of atoms. It has the ability to spatial resolution at an atomic scale and time resolution at a femtosecond scale, which is 1/1,000,000 of a second. And so we can image things that literally nobody else can see. These are the kind of tools that are beyond the cutting edge of science and are defining new fields and new technologies and new techniques, and that's part of what we do at the University of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, just a final comment. I think that what we've heard evidence of is that the University of Minnesota is unlike any other institution, and I think it behooves us to discontinue being quiet about some of the abilities that the University of Minnesota has and be a little more bold in advertising and, as the old slogan says, sell the sizzle. So with that, thank you for your time, President Kaler.
Thank you.
I just wanted to add one thing here to the conversation. Crookston, the University of Crookston has always had an ag history, and we're glad to see that that's kind of being brought back and revitalized. And so we appreciate that, and we hope that that same thing is true of Morris, where they've also had a long history. I believe that started as an ag school years and years ago. So if it can continue in that direction, we'd also be very encouraged.
Yes, Chair Norris, we are very sensitive to the need to respond to our ag colleagues, again, 20% approximately of the Minnesota economy is based on agriculture in one way or another, and we are the land-grant institution, whether it's developing new seeds, treating diseases, new species of plants. And we did scale back the ag education program at Crookston 6 or 7 years ago, and that was not a good thing to do. And so we're back in business there. Again, a very important feeder to the ag industry. Ironically, of course, we educate agriculture educators, and they are quickly snapped up by the ag firms in Minnesota. We find them remarkable customer service and sales and management agents rather than teaching high school students agriculture. So we continue to have a high demand for those individuals.
I can editorialize for a moment. Where I grew up, about 17 miles south of Crookston, where the university is located, the only thing keeping the town alive is agriculture, mm-hmm. and that's the honest truth. So, yep. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Chair Nornes. President Keller, I'd like to hear a little bit more about the residency program that has been funded through UCARE in the past at North Memorial. So how long had that been going on that was the funding source and the partnership with North Memorial?
So I suspect I hear Dr. Mack
moving
that's
my real purpose,
to the microphone, so I will yield to the director of that program to provide the accurate answer to you, Representative Pryor, with your permission.
Welcome to the...
Thank you, Dr. Taylor, and Representative Norris, thank you. And I would be happy to answer that question. So the North Memorial Program has been there for over 40 years, serving a very challenged area of North Minneapolis. It's one of eight family medicine residencies. And the funding for it used to come from the state legislature years ago. When I was a resident at Bethesda, it was similar. And then things changed over the years. The funding shifted, and for a while we had it through the tobacco endowment, and the tobacco endowment was then removed, or most of it was. And then for a year or two, we have had support from the tobacco taxes, and as that has gone up or down, the gap has remained about what you're hearing, about $6 or $8 million for the combined residencies and other activities of the department. So during those years, rather by accident, the Department of Family Medicine, which owned or used to own UCARE, UCARE developed a way to serve Medicaid populations on a prepaid basis, which caused the bankruptcy of every other organization of that type in the U.S., remained viable, and had a margin that was not always needed for the use of the insurance company. And by charter, when possible, that money came to the Department of Family Medicine for use of any type. Now, had I had all options for the past 15 years, I came here from actually Mayo, where I used to direct their insurance plan as a medical director. So came here not knowing what UCARE was going to develop. And over the years, when the gap was growing between what services could generate money for Medicaid patients and teaching programs, the opportunity to get money enough for teaching support dropped. UCARE became marginally profitable and offered this kind of resource. And instead of endowing chairs, which I think the university would have had me do, I and we chose to support these residencies, some of whom you see here. Absent that, those programs might have closed a decade ago. And the hospitals are very good partners, but they were also having trouble based on Medicaid fees, and that's who we serve mostly. And so as that gap continued, we asked for them more and more money. And as you see this year, one of our premier programs had to decrease by 20% to just stay open. We had hoped we would have had funding last year because I came with much the same story. And when asked last year before this committee, I was asked, what happens if we don't get funding? And I said, well, things happen somewhat slowly, but in a year or two, faculty leave, residencies shrink, then more faculty leave, and it takes a few years before the program entirely closes. That history was played out at Ramsey Hospital about 14 years ago. We lost 10 resident graduates per year when they closed that program. Now, we have never recovered those 10 residents. One of the university's programs used to have 10 residents per year about 8 years ago. It now has 6 per year. North Memorial just went from 10 to 8. We're heading in exactly the wrong direction at a time we need more primary care physicians, and especially primary care physicians who can practice both in rural areas as well as urban areas of need and consistently do so. So as we continue to be the university that produces more family physician graduates than anyone in the U.S. and more total graduates over the past 40 years than anyone in the U.S., we will start exporting those medical school graduates to Wisconsin, who is growing more family medicine residencies, to North Dakota, which is growing more family medicine residencies, to California, which is doing the same. So we will be exporting a very expensive product, a potential value to the state of Minnesota, and I don't like that. And I hope that it generates enough enthusiasm to spend an enormous amount of money that is no longer available to us through a prior source. And as the Commissioner of Human Services stated a couple of years ago, in front of the front page of the Minneapolis paper, the only time I was ever on the front page with her, was that that kind of money should come by legislative action. And she was right. It was accidentally good fortune on our part. We could get it from UCARE for about a decade. And that opportunity seems to have been removed. Thank you for the question.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I should introduce myself.
I'm just going to say, for the record, we need to know who you are.
I got carried away.
I know you did.
My name is Mac Baird. I'm professor and chairman of the Department of Family Medicine. I have 3 degrees at the University of Minnesota and grew up in another small town, this time in southern Minnesota. Okay. So I'm a graduate of here several times.
Great. Thank you very much. Just to add, thank you, Mr. Chair.
It seems like over the last 30 years, you know, from when my husband was in medical school, that that it was always the family practice that we were falling behind and not turning out physicians. And so, you know, to summarize from what you're telling me is the graduates from medical schools are there. It's just finding the residency slots right now.
Yes, and Mr. Chair and Representative, if I may, there are many reasons for the fact that we produce more family physician graduates than anybody in the country. It's partly because of all the contributions of voluntary teachers all over the state of Minnesota in the Rural Physician Associates Program, which you funded again last year in a new way. It's also the Duluth campus, which has special priority for primary care physicians heading for a rural career. And it's the state of Minnesota, which honors community commitment that we seem to acculturate and train people from high school on to want to serve their communities. You've heard of this person coming from far away to pick that theme up and want to stay here and practice here in Minnesota. So the whole set of circumstances in Minnesota yields double or more the rate of producing primary care physicians and the title of family physicians. It's not just one factor. But you can make a huge difference by helping support that funding. And I've tried not to come here all the years when we didn't have to, when we had funding for UCARE. I was rather urged to do so, and I felt I didn't have the ethical platform on which to stand to ask for money from the legislature when we had it available elsewhere. And as that has disappeared, you find me here raising the question again. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you. And someone else wants to speak,
well,
I think.
If I might add, in my search for residencies, I did interview all over the country from West Coast, East Coast, North, South, all over. And the commitment to family medicine that I felt here on behalf, on the part of the university and especially at the North Memorial Program, was unmatched anywhere. So I think that that really speaks to the history of family medicine here, and I think that students do feel that, and when they are training and working with our family physicians and faculty members, they feel our love for family medicine, and that is what I think inspires them to go into family medicine and why we have such a high rate of students that are going into family medicine. So that's something that is invaluable, and I just don't think that we can afford to lose it.
Thank you for coming down. Representative Schultz, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to commend you for bringing so many people with you, President Kaler, and I think the stories are powerful and they matter, and to hear from students is very important. I know you often get beat up. And it's hard being an administrator and being the president of a big system, and I just want to thank you for hanging in there. And I just want my Republican colleagues to know how important the university is to our state. And we're in a new world now, and the university is competing with more entities that want state money. But the university each year brings in close to $1 billion just in grants revenue, and that has a big economic effect on our state. And we need to be serious, and we need to continue that investment. We're competing with other states that have disinvested in their public higher ed institutions are hurting. And I would encourage my colleagues to watch the documentary called Starving the Beast to see other states that didn't invest in their public institutions, their land-grant institutions, and what happened to their economy. So I really hope that in our budgets we can fully fund these requests and continue that investment in the University of Minnesota system for our state, for our economy, for our students, and for all the wonderful research that goes on there. And we need to do a better job of selling ourselves and making people understand the value of the university to the state. And I would love to see more of you more often. Don't apologize for not coming. I would love to hear more stories more often. So I hope you guys come see us, visit us, and tell us those stories. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. We typically don't take other testimony or questions from other members in the audience, but Mark Hughes has something he'd like to add to the conversation, so we'll give him a moment.
Members of the committee, Chair Norris, my name is Mark Hughes. I want to make my comments very brief. I know it's going to be 4 to 5, but I too am an alumni of the University of Minnesota Carleton School. To be exact, it was so long ago it was Business Day School back then. But I wore my scarf because it's not cold in here. I just wanted
it
to
is a little cool, actually.
I wanted to show up the colors. I have other U of M clothes that I didn't wear today. But I want to make a few comments. In essence, all these folks that came here today, students, faculty, president of the university, Dr. Taylor, almost gave a president of the United States. But anyway, I want to tell you about the importance of the University of Minnesota, and I piggyback what Representative Schultz just said, that it's important to the state of Minnesota because it creates jobs, it's economics, it's these students here are tomorrow's future. And the most exciting thing we've heard today was people like Elizabeth and the other person who was doctor at North Memorial that accepted the job today. That's what it's all about, is going beyond what the university. But the university has given us the tools to carry on. And so I'm going to be very brief. We have a program at Carleton School of Management that is called First Tuesday. It'll be next Tuesday, so I'll be here in time for committee, but I'll be having lunch over there. Our alumni gets together, and we usually have an alumni come in and speak. Sometimes they aren't alumni. And we even had Governor Dayton at one time who started out in the doctoral program but then went to political science. So we've had some really great speakers over there, and anyone is invited. We started out with alumni, but anyone's invited. In closing, I hope one of the thrills that I've got on this committee this year in trying to help out with it is to do the Board of Regents, and I met David McMillan, and what a thrill. I hope I really get to sit down and learn more from him. So, thank you for what the University of Minnesota has done for me, for the alumni. We even had Dr. Taylor come out to Beco Industries and White Bear Lake to help out with the White Bear Chamber Congress event, which I belong to, and so it was nice of him. And so thank him also for what he's done in every Saturday football game. So thank you.
Thank you, Mark. And President McKillar, I think you had a couple more regents that showed up during the hearing.
I did see Regent Hsu and Regent Rocha, and I believe...
I think that's...
Somebody's pointing over there. I don't see any reason.
McMillan was here. And now
That's where McMillan was. So thank you. Thank you, Chair Norris.
I believe we've come to the end of our presentation from the university, and we appreciate very much the effort you've put into this. Very educational, very enlightening, especially when you import them all the way from Perm. I mean, that's very, very impressive.
The reach of the university is very broad, Chair Norris. We're happy to be able to be here with you. Thank you.
And the invitation to come back up there is open as soon as the lakes open up. So,
when you get the dock in, let me know.
All right. Very good. And if there's no other business, we are adjourned.